Okay, hello and welcome to English Language Teachers Under the Covers. I am again today, Neil of Team Teacher Fame, joined by my co-host, Professor Rich. And today we have a very, very special guest, a teacher trainer, a storyteller, author of online video in the classroom, images, video telling, lead singer of Kings of Leon, master of the story arts, the man, the myth, the legend, Jamie Keddy. I'm not sure about the Kings of Leon thing. When I put your image in Google Images, that's what came up, and I was like, this is very confusing.
Oh, really? Yeah. Is there a similarity? Who is the lead singer of Kings of Leon these days?
This Caleb Nichols or whatever. It came up, I was like, oh, I've got to throw this in there.
Well, it's a very similar name, you see. Anagrams. My name and his name are anagrams of each other. That's why.
So we're going to go into a bit of your origin story. But before we do that, I've got a hard question, because we spoke not so long ago with Patrick Jackson, and we said, you know, we're possibly going to be speaking with Jamie Keddy, and he referred to you as a rascal. Can you confirm or deny that accusation?
Patrick is a hilarious man, isn't he?
I love him. I love his books.
Are either of you on Clubhouse?
No.
Clubhouse is an audio-only app. It's, you join rooms of live conversation. Mm-hmm. And I've been... You know, I hadn't seen Patrick or been in touch with Patrick for a number of years, and we've only just recently connected on Clubhouse. And the banter that comes from between him, well, usually starts with him. He'll always refer to me. And in fact, he's called me a rascal on more than one occasion. I don't know where he gets this. I assumed he called everybody a rascal, but maybe not. I don't know.
Maybe he is in fact the rascal. He's projecting.
He's definitely a rascal. Okay, I used to be more of a rascal than I am now.
So, Jamie, I mean, you've been teaching for a long time now, but do you mind giving us kind of your background and how you came to be the Jamie Keddy, the storyteller?
Is this the origin story?
Yeah, if you don't mind.
Origin stories often being associated with superheroes, right?
That's the implication.
That's how it was understood. Yes. So the implication is that teachers are superheroes then.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if, you know, I'll tell you my origin story. You can decide whether I'm a superhero. I don't think I am, because let's face it, how many Nobel Prizes do we have between us? Not many. You know, so it's great, I think. But when it all starts, let's go back to the year 1994. Perhaps neither of you were born.
No, I was born. That was the US World Cup, right? 94.
That's right. That's right. It was. You know, I was offered, I was in New York at the time of the final. I was offered a ticket to the final for $80. I was so broke I couldn't afford it. But anyway, that's not what the origin story. 1994. I just finished a degree in biochemistry at Aberdeen University, you see. Really hard work. 4 years of very hard work studying science. But I was a bit of a lousy scientist, you see. Very clumsy. I had a habit of breaking lots of equipment. And who knows what nasty substances out of, putting your fingers in your mouth, you know, I might have, what my origin story might have been, I might have turned out as being E. coli man. And so for the progression of science, I had to leave the profession. And there was a passion I had, something that I'd always wanted to do ever since I was a kid, but never fulfilled it. And that thing was not to be an English teacher, but to be a musician.
Oh.
I used to play a bit of piano, but I wanted to do it properly. You know, I wanted to go professional, may I say it. And I thought when I finished my degree, you see, at Aberdeen University in 1994, I thought, that's it. I'm not going to do science. I'm going to turn my back on science. I'm going to go to Leeds College of Music, and I'm going to study to be a musician. And that's exactly what I did. I had to blag my way in because I wasn't very good, but I managed to get in, and thus began six self-indulgent years of learning to play piano and also a bit of singing.
Wow.
And
That's very interesting background.
Yeah.
From full academia to full arts.
I don't know if there's a connection, Neil, but I hear that lots of scientists become musicians, or lots of musicians have scientific tendencies. I don't know. I can't verify. It's just anecdotal here.
Yeah, there could be something to it.
Yeah.
I've always thought there's a lot of, I guess we'll be getting to this, but I've always thought there's a lot of parables between learning a musical instrument and learning a language.
Well, that is communication. Yes. I mean, that is the science that throws me off. I can understand the music because, you know, you're just communicating in a different way. But with science, yeah.
I never thought about that third one, the science and music connection I was got, but then the language, yeah. But I really worked. No, I didn't. I mean, you know, when you say you work hard at music college, that means you lock yourself away and practice for like 8 or 9 or 10 hours a day. Mm-hmm. I never did that. But I did practice 3 hours a day for pretty much most days for those 6 years. And by the end of the 6 years, I think I had what I wanted, and it was a job in a ship. And it wasn't a glamorous ship. It was a ferry that went between Hull and Bruges.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And I was the entertainment. So I would be playing songs like Nina Simone and Nat King Cole and pop and jazz and blues and anything really, even a bit of Radiohead if I fancied it. But and although it was very unglamorous, I had the glamorous jobs lined up. I actually had a cruise in the Caribbean next. And it was great because I was earning money, you know, there's nowhere to spend it.
Yeah.
And I practiced during the day and I played during the night. And that was my life for a good, I don't know, five years. You know what? I should have picked out some photographs to show you.
Well, you can always send them through to us and we'll throw them up.
They're actually hard copy ones. They're not digital. So But anyway, what happened next was a personal tragedy. I got tendonitis in my arms from playing too much, and it became quite painful. So painful that I had to leave the ship. And not while we were at sea, yeah. I should say. Yeah, it wasn't that bad.
Swim home.
But when we were at dock, so I left the ship, and I went home, I'd see a doctor, and the doctor said, you've got to take off at least 6 months from the playing. And so I was self-sufficient. I had the dream job I wanted, the Caribbean cruise lined up, and ended up going back to Scotland, where I'm from, to stay with my mum and dad again. And they had to look after me, and I moped around the house, meaning I just existed there without any sort of purpose, feeling down. And my mum said, Jamie, enough's enough. Why don't you go to Barcelona? You always wanted to do that. And do one of those, what they call those TEFL courses. Mm-hmm. And I went, all right, mum, that's what I'm going to do. So I went to Barcelona to do one of those TEFL courses. And I did it. And then slowly, my passion started to move away from music and into teaching and into language and into visuals and into visual material and into images and into video. And this was just the time of the emergence of YouTube, you see. So, yes, we're probably about 3/4 of the way through my origin story. We've got to the kind of the main destination of me being a teacher here. Mm-hmm. Are any questions so far?
I mean,
so you.
Oh, go ahead, Rich.
Well, I was just going to say. So the basic summary is your mum decided for you to be a teacher.
Yeah, that's a short version. I became a teacher because of my mum.
Well, I was going to ask how your background with education is really interesting with the biochemistry and the musical. I'm just wondering how much of that informed, you know, you as a teacher now, in your opinion, or, you know, like, you must have come from quite research-orientated, rigorous academia with the biochemistry, and then to kind of go into more, I guess, free-flowing, you know, arts-based with the music. It's just a really interesting combination. How much of that do you think there's an impact on the way that you approach teaching now, or generally just in life? Because it's kind of, you know, two hemispheres almost.
I mean, it you know, the scientific days are well gone, but, you know, you do retain a bit of a scientific mind, or at least I've always maybe had a rational mind. And, you know, I'm not an applied linguist. I'm much more of a practitioner, you know, in my approach. Mm-hmm. But it's hard work when you go to conferences, for example, and you get people talking about stuff that you should just know is BS. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you just go, oh God. And so there's that little part of me. But I think it's hard. It has gone from very much from a science to an arts sort of existence. Mm-hmm. And I think the two very much do connect. I mean, I would hate to have only ever been in science. Mm-hmm. And I would hate to only ever been in arts. Mm-hmm. When I say arts, I mean, I'm thinking about the story and the storytelling thing. Mm-hmm. But I do feel it's quite a healthy balance. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Although I don't think anybody has to study a 4-year course in biochemistry to be a scientist. I think you just need to take any vague interest in science and, you know, start thinking about it, start watching, you know, write documentaries, reading a few books, and you're there. You know, it's just as soon as you start taking interest in it, and people are, there's plenty of artists and artistic types who are rational thinkers.
Well, it's just from the stuff that I read from you, and I was reading an article the other day that you did for Oxford Press, and what really caught my eye was when you were talking about perspectives with images, and you were talking about you know, the objective, effective, and contextual, and I was like, this is very interesting, because there's a lot more reflection and kind of looking at it in layers. The approach reminded me of, I don't want to say a scientific method, but it reminded me of an analysis, a very accurate analysis of, you know, the way people deal with images. And, you know, you saying that you've got this background, I was like, oh, made me think, oh, maybe that's kind of how it kind of comes out.
I would maybe say that the connection here is more of a kind of philosophical approach. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't read a lot. I often say that, but I think I read a little. I think a lot, and I'm constantly thinking about communication more than anything. I write a lot. Mm-hmm. I write every day, constantly thinking about how to simplify complex ideas. And what you mentioned just there, Neil, was an attempt to simplify things. If you were to go to study, for example, visual communication and talk mm-hmm. about certain perspectives, mm-hmm. things can get very complex. But I think for language teachers, and for many teachers anyway, we can simplify things to those three perspectives. And I find that to be quite helpful, especially when working with materials, especially video and images. Yeah, so there's a bit of a philosophy that I maybe that's the word, possibly, yeah.
Yeah, there was a lot of an analysis, and self-reflection that I saw with a lot of your materials, and you know, it just kind of, I wondered how much that was reflecting on your scientific background. But Rich is actually the philosophy major, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to say some stuff there about lesson stream, but I think I imagine that we're just about to come to that part of the story now, so I might save it until.
Yes, you're right. That's where we are. You know, I was really passionate about teaching language to learners, and that is where I was heading. And I used to, in this very flat I'm in right now, I used to stay up very late writing. I was probably writing a sort of similar, some kind of version of Murphy's Grammar for Learners, but slightly more wacky, you know, and writing stuff, you know, cheat sheets and grammar explanations, the usual kind of thing, but with some slightly sort of bizarre ways of approaching it. And somehow I got misaligned. I got taken off that track and put in another track, which was to work with and work for teachers. And I sometimes wonder what life would have been like if that hadn't happened. So working with teachers meant exploiting materials. And it's a very interesting thing I've always found, because I think at the center of what I've always done is lesson plans. And Rich just mentioned Lesson Stream. And Lesson Stream was a website that I started in 2007, 1 year after the birth of YouTube. Because language teachers, for years, if they wanted to use video in the classroom, they'd had to book the TV, they had to wheel it out of a cupboard, they had to make sure not to drop it on a student, and you know, you were limited to what you could get from the DVDs. We had this sort of visual diet of like Mr. Bean and Fawlty Towers and Wallace and Gromit. If you wanted to use an advert, you know, you'd have to be lucky enough to have recorded it by accident from your TV. And even then, you know, there was, when I got into teaching, it was all DVDs, so there was no VHS, so adverts were just out of the question. Mm-hmm. And so suddenly YouTube came along, and there was this explosion, and not just new genres and new types of video and new types of story, but an accessibility, a total accessibility. So it was fantastic for me to go back to all these videos I wanted to use adverts mainly and be able to use them in the classroom for once. And so writing lesson plans based primarily on these new things, it's called YouTubes. We used to call them, I sent you a YouTube, did you get it? And so writing lesson plans based on YouTubes. And that was Lesson Stream, and that was the start, I think, of how people got to know me. It was my website, lessonstream.org, it was called at the time, it's now .com. And it was just a free-for-all, come and get your lesson plans, take them away, have them, don't even leave your email, just take it. Why am I not asking you for email? Because I've got no idea what I'm doing.
Well, that's how we all start, isn't it? And then you kind of feel it out from there. And then realize, hold on, I've put so much love into this, and people would just snatch it in a way.
Yeah, I think if I could go back, like, because I don't know when it was that when I first started making YouTube videos, but I think it was maybe about 2008, 2009, so it's around about that time as well when I first started Professor Breach. And like, if I could go back there with, like, you know, knowledge of what I could have done with it, and you know, it might still be kind of my main activity now, you know what I mean? Like, there's all kinds, but at the time I was just, I don't know, I was just doing it because I enjoyed it, really, you know? I got something out of it, and presumably, you know, I assume that you were getting something out of Lesson Stream, Jamie. I mean, there's a lot of creativity there, so presumably it was a big sort of creative outlet for you.
Yeah, it was, that, you know, with my youth, my lots of passion and energy, and time to create something for the sake of wanting to create it. And that is something that you associate with younger types, isn't it? And so, yes, I did get other things out of it. I got a bit of a, name for myself in the profession, I guess. I got to write two books for Oxford University Press. I got invited to lots of conferences and do workshops, and ended up going to exactly, I think I've worked in 44 countries. Awesome. So that was all before COVID. I don't think those days will ever return. So it was a lot of fun, and I have to apologise to the planet for the carbon footprint that I left behind. But we were young. I was young. I didn't know. Maybe we did. Maybe I'm just excusing myself. I don't know.
Well, now you can put all those lesson plans onto your tablet or other digital device. It's just the technologies didn't intercede at that point. They needed to catch up, I guess. But it's interesting with the lesson stream, because you kind of like an early adopter of YouTube as what it is now as a resource, as something where you can take it and turn it into material for the classroom. Whereas before, when he first started doing it, it was, I'm teaching over video. This is a video thing. Whereas that's the video is not the main component, in that you're not just showing the video, but you're mining it for lessons. So
So there's kind of that idea of authentic material, right?
Yeah.
YouTube is authentic material, isn't it? You can easily do. Easily have a look at YouTubers having conversations and find all kinds of interesting language points to look at if you want.
And I mean, I've always had a thing about authentic materials, if we call them authentic materials not made for the learning of languages or teaching of languages. And I've often thought, what is it? Why do teachers go off piste? Why do we feel the need to turn to sites like YouTube? And I think it took me years to get the answer. And my feeling is quite simple, is that we need story. And that's what YouTube provides us with. That's what authentic materials give us. We want something which is more compelling, something with a narrative. Whether it's a news article, whether it's a piece of art, whether it's a photograph from a fantastic photojournalist, whether it's a YouTube video, a short film, an advert, it's narrative. And so I think when we think of authentic materials, we can think of difficult texts, but in fact, authentic materials is the quest for story beyond the course book. And I think if course books provided us with a truly good supply of stories, I think teachers would probably go in search of authentic materials less.
Yeah. Well, I mean, some of them do. Some of the ones that sort of stick in my head do. Because, I still sometimes use as the basis of my lesson, some old thing that I saw in, a copy of, I don't know if we should name names, but let's say a classic course book from 10 years ago. Like, this particular one, a story of... These guys who go into the jungle in the Amazon rainforest, four men go in and not all of them come out alive. And it's a true story. It's based on a true story. And I got that, originally in the copy of this course book. But that's something I still use today because it's a great story.
And
people instantly hooked on it. It's got all these interesting elements.
Absolutely. I remember teaching once in Barcelona, teaching a particularly difficult class. There was one student in particular who was very problematic. I've never been a particularly good disciplinarian. He was very, very challenging. He wouldn't speak English. He wouldn't get involved in activities. He just would not do anything despite my best efforts. I remember the only time he ever demonstrated any sort of interest was when he was flicking through his coursebook, and he came to this section, and it was a story about this woman who lived in an old jumbo jet. And I think that perhaps it may have been Headway. And he looked at it, and he was just transfixed in this. You know, he looked at me and says, the first time he actually used English, he said, he's incredible. Remember, what is it? He's incredible. She leaving a plane. Is the only time he ever used English. And I suppose back in those, this is a long time ago as well, and I'd been trying to teach grammar and the like, you know, making that mistake. And so there's, I mean, two things. Number one, yes, it's not all course books are devoid of story. However, you mentioned an old course book, and so have I, Rich, and I do see fewer compelling stories in modern course books. It just seems to be more of the same.
I was wondering about that as well. Like, I've looked at some kind of new editions of coursebooks, because, you know, kind of looking for something. It seems very much like it's the same thing as they were kind of writing, you know, 10 or even 15 years ago, you know what I mean? Like, and even, again, the idea of focusing the whole thing around grammar, the whole book is built around, like, this grammar syllabus. Like, now we're going to do the present perfect or whatever. And it's like, I thought we got past that some time ago, you know, but.
I think the problem with course books is they try to base all their units on topics. They choose interesting topics, and they'll start off with maybe a picture. It might be, if it's a good picture, that's great, but they'll have some questions about a topic. What do you think of this? How often do you do this? Where do you do this? And this sort of thing. Now, I don't think you can really, for me, if I would never do that in my wildest dreams. They always start with a story. Mm-hmm. And the story will set the scene. Mm-hmm. The story will give rise to the topic, and it'll also give rise to the issues. And it'll give those issues or what you want to react against or react with. Or it's the issues that make you wake up. You know, topics. The future. Yeah, the future. What have you got to say about it, eh? What have you got to say about it? You know, that's the topic. A story could be, I don't know, Elon Musk and his current day nonsense, which I enjoy watching. You know, you can't just use a topic and suddenly go into a conversation about it. You've got to, there's must be a story. And by story, I can mean a good image with an engaging, interesting narrative that serves as a story. But you can't go straight. You can't just choose a topic and choose a few library royalty free images to accompany it. That's not going to work. Mm-hmm. That's my problem with course books.
Mm. Yeah, I also feel like Jamie. I don't know if this is something you're kind of consciously aware of, or whether it's anything anyone's commented to you before, but I feel like your definition of a story is somewhat broader than what someone might just think of when they think of the word story. In that, it very much seems to me that you what you're really looking for is like what grabs people, what compels people, and what is it that people want to know more about, right? So it's like when you see something, you go, oh, this is interesting, you know, and kind of it provokes these thoughts in your head, then that becomes something that's maybe a good place to start for a lesson plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, video is a very good example of that. So through the lesson plans that I created, I started to see video as being not a digital file, not even necessarily a sequence of moving images accompanied by an audio, but seeing it as a story and seeing how human beings react or interact with it, to respond to it. And, you know, we put video narratives into words. You know, we might end up telling each other about our favorite clips. This happened to me just the other day, in fact. By complete coincidence, I discovered that my friend Darren is also currently going through a revival of the series The Wire.
Oh, great.
And we've just both finished it. It was incredible how we started and finished it both at the same time without even being aware of this.
And we went out for a couple of beers, lunchtime beers, Saturday, and we were just going over our favourite moments from The Wire, laughing at it, putting them into words, choosing our favourite little scenes, our favourite moments when this happened to that guy or this happened to that woman or whatever. And we were just laughing, putting them into words. And this required storytelling abilities in order to recall and relay that narrative that originated from video. And we do this all the time. Imagine a little girl telling her parents, you know, passionately how polar bears hunt for seals. Not because she's been to the North Pole, but because she saw it on a TV program, you know? Or telling a friend about a funny viral video you've just seen. I was desperately trying to find a TikTok video to show somebody the other day, and I couldn't find it, so I ended up having to describe it, putting it into words. You know, this is what I refer to as video telling, but it goes into picture telling as well. It goes into describe. It's putting narratives that come from a whole range of sources back into words and storing them here and retrieving them for whatever reason, whatever purpose. Yeah.
It's very interesting because it seems to be the most engaging way to kind of go with these materials. But it reminds me of Superman. I'm a big Superman fan growing up, and everyone always would just give me shit, you know, because, you know, he's got all the powers and, you know, he can do everything. What's so interesting about that? And I always thought of Superman, and there's some great stories where he is this person, or he's a god basically, but he still deals with human issues, and he still makes this choice every day, instead of, you know, being able to rule us all, that he can he chooses instead to be a symbol for betterment or for you know, helping others. So that there's lots of, and the best stories with him are ones where you see the restrictions, where, you know, he can fly around the world, but, you know, if there's a coup going on in one part of the world and Lois is stuck in the other, you know, he can't do everything. You know, he can't battle government, you know, restrictions and stuff like that. And, you know, kind of when I go and tell people, you know, why I really engage with Superman, you know, they can kind of see my perspective and maybe see it in a different way. And it kind of sounds similar to like what you're saying. If when you're doing these videos and you're telling them, you're giving this person a new perspective, a new way of seeing this, and you're helping them connect on that same emotional level that you are. And you know, I think that's incredibly important in the classroom. And one of the issues, like you say, with the course books is they just make these topics. But that's not what's interesting. It's how we connect with them, how we relate to them. And, you know, I guess that's what often you get when you are given a course, but you're kind of, as a teacher, a decent teacher would find a way to relate. How can I relate this with my student, or how can I relate to this material? And then, you know, you can deliver that. But is that sound... I just waffled, sorry.
I think that sounds absolutely spot on. I think that teachers too often feel that they should be banished to the sort of, I don't know, to the sideline. You know, it's about, you know, I've heard teachers saying things like, because I train teachers to be storytellers. I train teachers to tell stories better, not necessarily, yeah, you know, to find stories, to tell stories. And that's not to say I'm telling teachers to talk for 30 minutes to a room of silent students. It really is not. I'm attracted to short, snappy, bite-sized stories. But to see stories in the materials, as you say, Neil, to see stories in the course book, which allow you to connect the course book with your students. But so often teachers, I think, or feel their role is relegated to one of sort of technician. We push the buttons, we press play, we tell students open their course books at page whatever. We play, you know, why would we, if that's not the case, why would teachers be also too happy to subject their students to these most awful, and I stress the word awful in the most harshest way possible, audio recordings, which are two boring, fictitious people with zero story between them going on about some banal drivel and nonsense. And yet they feel they're not allowed to talk, you know?
Yeah.
I think there's this idea that teacher talk should always be kept down to a minimum. And let's say for argument's sake, I agree with that. And in fact, in some ways I do. I think that if you really, really want to be able to control your teacher talk, be a master classroom communicator, the key is to become a storyteller and learn how to be efficient with your language, learn what's important. Understanding story, understanding how it works is an absolute key part for any communicator's toolkit. And that is especially for teachers and educators. This all came from your idea, Neil, about connecting the course book to students. I couldn't think of a better example myself as a way to illustrate that.
Well, it's really interesting because one of the main things with your video telling, and as you stress about storytelling, people often forget that, you know, through our history, that's how we acquired knowledge. I mean, the previous year, I took my students to the Vancouver Museum, and Vancouver's within First Nation territory. So there's a lot of Haida Gwaii history, and there's not many written stories by the elders of, you know, like First Nations peoples. And the stories that they do have, is just videos. They've just got lots and lots of videos at the museum of these elders telling the stories, and that's how it was passed through. And I think there's some innate thing within storytelling that is absolutely necessary for learning that we can't connect with in any other way. And what really, really hammered that home to me, even before, you know, reading your stuff, was I hated Shakespeare growing up, and I just couldn't get the Iliad. You know, when I try and read it, and you're like, oh, you're supposed to, you know, it's supposed to be a classic. And I loved like all the Harryhausen, you know, Jason and the Argonauts kind of stuff. So I really wanted to really like the book. And it was only until getting Audible where I heard the book and I'm like, it needs to be spoken. Same with Shakespeare. You know, you don't understand Shakespeare until you hear Blessed do it, you know? So yeah, there's so much difference between reading to be or not to be, and then to hear that, you know, uttered by, you know, a professional. It's so essential. So I think, you know, when you're doing video telling and I'm reading your stuff, I'm like, this guy gets it, and he's tapping into maybe something that's even part of our biology in a way, you know, to be a bit outlandish, but you know, maybe it is, you know, like we were talking about before the podcast, where you have to write stuff down to really feel like you're remembering it. Maybe it is something within us that we need.
And I think that I'm sure that we need narrative. Humans need narrative, and that's all humans. I can't speak for newly born babies, but I think we all developed humans need stories of some kind or another. And you could say, well, they're presented to in the classroom. They come in the form of authentic materials, let's say. But it's still, you can't just let the stories come from the materials. You can't just let the artifacts do the job. Artifacts need museum guides, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, it's almost like, another, you mentioned the course book, Neil. And even if the story of the day is provided by a video, you cannot just as a teacher say, hey, kids, I'm going to show you a video. Watch this. You ready? Press play, then press pause. What do you think happens next? I mean, you know, if you had a speaker visiting your classroom, would you have the speaker come in at 9 o'clock on Monday morning when the class starts and just keep stay in your chair and let the speaker come on stage and introduce himself? You need to contextualize it. You need to tell your students why you've chosen this video, how you got it, how why you chose it, why it chose you. Even the tiniest, most seemingly trivial or mundane facts make connections between the teacher and the material, or invitations for students to make connections between themselves and the material and find themselves ultimately in this story. Even your idea, Neil, about if your course book of the day is about unusual pets, and that's the topic, unusual pets, tell your students, start the topic by telling your students very quickly about an unusual pet that you had. Maybe they can guess what the unusual pet was. Maybe describe it. And then, okay, by the way, topic of the day, unusual pets. Now open your books, go to page 43. If you don't get that first part, you're denying your students something which should be meaningful and humane and human-like. And, you know, this is it's exactly what you're saying. Yes, watch out, get carried away.
Yeah, no, it reminded me actually when you said that, Jamie. That was actually something that that I learned on the dip. One of the things I used to do is I would just be kind of casually chatting with the students about stuff, and then I'd kind of stand up and I'd be like, "Okay, and today we're going to do," you know, and it's like it was actually quite a grating moment. It was Nicola that spotted this because it's like, well, you know, why does it have to be this like, oh, and now the class has started, when like, actually, what was going on before that was actually really interesting, and there was like authentic communication between you and the students, and it was getting onto the topic anyway, you know. So does it really need to suddenly be like, okay, now we can pull the curtain aside and the show begins, when the show really has already begun?
Absolutely. Yeah, we've all done it. We've all been there. This is what the profession sets you up to do. I think it misdescribes our job. Teachers would be forgiven for assuming that their job is to be a ghost and, you know, to present the materials in the most meaningless way possible and tell your students that today they're going to learn how to use adverbs of frequency so that they can talk about the things they like doing and how often they like doing them, which is a very narrative weak way of doing things, but it is a very standard way of doing things. And I think it's understandable. I don't want to sound like I'm being critical of teachers, because it can be very difficult to see through it. And also, it can be very difficult to do it. The teaching English is actually very hard. It's remarkably difficult. And I think it's sold as something that's quite easy. It takes a month to learn how to do it. You know, even less if you get a non-CELTA, non-CERT TESOL certificate, you can do it in a weekend. You know, I think it's, you know, whatever you do, do it silently, don't talk, press buttons, know how to set up a reading, know how to set up listening, you're on your way. And we know that that is not what makes a good teacher. We know that.
It's almost like they don't want a skilled teacher. And I don't think it's that, you know, generally schools don't want a skilled teacher. It's that, I mean, if we go from just private schools but to the public education system in general, there's a need for a uniformity, a need for this is the curriculum, follow that. But it's often, you know, the teacher and individual is forgotten. The stamp that they put on these materials is, you know, by the wayside, and you know, it just means you end up with a lot of kids disconnected.
I think
from
sometimes
their education.
Sometimes it definitely is. Yeah, absolutely. I remember one of the worst examples I ever faced of that was when there was a specific course at actually a very good school that I was teaching at quite recently. Not going to name the name. They were specifically doing this IELTS course, and the material was really prescriptive. And it was quite unusual, because this particular school, like in every other way, they were so encouraging of like teachers to develop the materials, come up with your own materials, collaborate with other teachers and come up with stuff, you know. But then for this particular course, which was, I don't know if it was something to do with the fact it was an IELTS course and the way they were marketing it or something, it was completely 100% prescriptive to the point where they actually supplied you with a locked PowerPoint that you couldn't edit. And they told you, you must go through every slide on this PowerPoint and do not change it. And it was just so odd, you know, it was so prescriptive. And I you know, it, that was really cultivating.
What's the point of you being there?
decultivating the environment of kind of, you know, what the teacher can bring to the classroom. Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I thought when I got it. I was kind of like, oh, why don't we just email this to the students? They can do it themselves.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. The perfect teacher is one who almost isn't necessary, is the way you could be forgiven. And in fact, this has been sold through the embodiment of Sugata Mitra, who was behind the what's known as the Hole in the Wall project. He installed a computer terminal into a, basically behind a wall in New Delhi slum and filmed the reactions from the kids. And the kids kind of got themselves into what he referred to self-organized learning. And he reported back on all this. And the implication was that teachers get in the way of learning. And he, through his work, he wanted to demonstrate that teachers aren't actually necessary at all. And he came and gave this as a presentation, as a plenary speaker at IATEFL in Harrogate a few years ago, International Association of Teachers of English as a Foreign Language. And he got a standing ovation. And you've got to ask yourself, is that, any other profession, could you get a standing ovation if I was to tell, I don't know, waiters that they get in the way of a diner's dining experience,
doesn't make any sense.
And the waiters get up and clap. And also it plays straight into the hands of the likes of EdTech and who would love to hear this sort of thing, that they can get straight between a nice, clean connection between whatever it is that they've got to offer being created from the San Francisco or wherever the hell, straight to the minds of the students, back to the sort of battery chicken style images of teaching without any need for teachers. It's perfect. It's just what they need. So teachers, by not reacting against the sort of stuff, I think we put ourselves at risk.
I think the problem where that kind of came from is because there is sort of this idea that there's an element of the traditional education system, which everyone sees as kind of outdated, because you had this education system that, you know, I'm sure everyone's kind of heard this anecdote about how it was basically made post-industrial revolution. The idea is that you're training people to be factory workers, you know, everyone's got to be the same little robot that goes to the factory and does or whatever. And therefore there are elements of that, you know, and you get these kind of nasty terms like chalk and talk and this kind of stuff. And I think that, I guess, people were kind of thinking, well, that has to change. There has to be something we can do about that. And maybe, someone like Sugata Mitra comes along and definitely, you know, throws the baby out with the bathwater. But, you know, it can appear to be a solution to that problem, but maybe not the correct one.
Yeah, yes.
I'd even say that, you know, what Sugata Mitra said, you know, it could be true to an extent if it's a certain unskilled teacher that's just, you know, teacher as entertainer. Whereas there's, you know, when you talk about teacher as storyteller, that's a whole different thing, because what they're doing, as you say, Jamie, is contextualizing the learning points rather than just, you know, teacher talk time, blah, 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 look at me. So, you know, I can see certain elements of that, but, you know, I don't agree.
With Sugata Mitra or with me?
Yeah, with Sugata Mitra, sorry. There's going to be a lot of teachers, you know, native English teachers, non-native English teachers, students watching this. And, you know, what would you say without giving away all your secrets? And, you know, obviously we'll redirect them to lessonstream.com to get more information. But, you know, if you could give us a snippet or a bit of a secret as to, you know, where would you start if you want to be this, you know, storyteller to create this teacher that, you know, that we've just been describing?
I want to give all my secrets away. I generally do. I would say, okay, three pieces of advice. Number one, don't assume that you have to get materials to provide the stories. You know, let's imagine you have to teach a subject or teach a class on the subject of misunderstandings. Why are you looking for a video to do the work? Flick through your memories. I'm sure you can find a very short anecdote, a situation involving you and some friends and a misunderstanding. And so that's the first thing. The second thing is start small. You said this before. Look for stories that are bite-sized. I mentioned misunderstandings. I love stories about misunderstandings, but stories about your own language learning experiences, especially failures, those are gold. And if they're funny, why are we not using them, you know? So start small, tell a story. And the third thing is, I think that people don't say this, and because what's the secret to good storytelling? You know, people, you ask that, what makes a good storyteller? People to look at the performance and things, mention things like gesture, eye contact, body language, look at articulation, voice quality. But the secret to good storytelling, rather, is not about the performance. It's about the preparation and the reflection. You know, you've got to think about how you're going to tell your story. You've got to create some kind of script, even if it's just in your head or just a sequence of very basic bullet points. But you've got to prepare it and think about how you're going to tell it, how you're going to start it, structure it, what's important, what's not important, what can you discard? What does it mean to you, and why are you telling it? Are there any questions you can ask your students, either before, during, or after? If it's a very short story, I don't recommend too many questions, but there are usually, if not always, questions we can ask students to get them involved in order to try and make it their story as well. So those are the three things. Number one, consider your own stories first. Number two, start small, bite-sized stories. Number three, develop them. And development means not just preparation, but reflection.
Mm.
And if I give one more for luck, collect them. Collect your stories. I use an app. I use an app called Bear. I'm just
Bear is in the animal.
Yes, just like the animal. So this is an app. These are all my stories. So the most recent story is called Awkward Barcelona Street Interaction, which is not the sexiest title, but it's a story in development. It's a working title.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So
fantastic. This is gold.
One of the things that kind of triggered off in my mind, actually, when you were talking about that, and you were talking about, you know, going for sort of personal stories first. And I think one of the things that sort of appeals about that to me is I always feel that whenever I'm into it, the students are also into it. So if I'm like giving a lesson about something that I find interesting, then it's like infectious, you know, that my interest in this subject or in this story, right, or the emotional elements of this story, you know, the this emotional memory, these memories of this thing that was embarrassing or funny or whatever it was, when I kind of relive those moments, then the students can really pick up on that, and it that kind of draws them into you know, that narrative as well.
that's absolutely beautifully said. You know, mm-hmm. when we're talking about the teacher as a storyteller, the image that we've got to banish from our mind is a monologue, a 30-minute monologue with silent listeners. It's those tiny little things that Neil's mentioned, connecting the course book with the teachers, are selling the material. I mean, when did a teacher, using graded readers, for example, I'm giving a talk in Italy online, actually. So it's not really in Italy, teachers encouraging their students to read and looking at different techniques. And one of the most fundamental ones, if you're using a single book for the whole class, is just to tell the students beforehand how much you yourself love it and why, what it means to you, that it's just such a fantastic story. And that goes so far. Students might not agree with you, but it's going to make them, but it's going to just enhance their enjoyment a little bit. And if it doesn't, they might even end up saying, well, I didn't enjoy it that much, but I really like the fact there's somebody who does. Maybe there's something I'm missing. What could it be? That it just is a richer experience all around me. It's how human beings work. You know, it's as simple as that. That to me is where storytelling is, and that's what it's all about.
Yeah, that reminded me of one of your old lessons on Lesson Stream, that the one about the you used the video about the Capuchin monkeys, and one of the the big moments in that lesson is when the students are listening without seeing the video and they hear the audience laugh at what the monkeys are doing. And at that moment, like, the whole class is hooked on, they want to know why the audience laughed. Like, you can see it. Even like the kid at the back who normally isn't paying attention is suddenly like, why did they laugh? Why did they laugh? What happened?
Can I ask you a question, Rich?
Of course.
You don't happen to have a copy of my book Video Telling with you, do you?
Oh, I keep it on my desk 24/7.
I know you've got one because I sent it to you. And I don't have a copy. Because I gave my last one. I think that was my second last one. giving them away. But I want to just tell you. Let me tell you the story of why you have that book. Is it okay if I do so?
Of course.
Oh, cool.
Because it's very, for me, I really like the story. Well, as you know, Rich, and as I assume you know, Neil, Rich did a diploma. Trinity diploma course in Barcelona. And as part of his course, he had to make a video in which he had to describe, am I right in saying it, you had to describe an aha moment?
It was something like that. It was something like something that inspired me as a teacher or something like that.
So Rich made this video, all of the trainees on the course had to make a video in which they described an aha moment in their career, something that made them go, ah, and caused the penny to drop and perhaps take a step in their development in some way or another. Now, Nicola said to me, listen, and this is before I'd met Rich, we've got this trainee in the course, he's called Rich, and he's made this video, as they all do, and his aha moment, he's mentioned your website, Lesson Stream. And, he said some really nice things about it. And so I tracked down Rich to make sure it was okay for me to see the video. And I watched this video, and it was absolutely incredible to see somebody put into words the things that you want to communicate, you know. And what you, one of the things you mentioned, that you just mentioned there, Rich, was the creation of curiosity, building up curiosity in your students by, you know, using this very simple device of, the device is simple, playing the video so students can hear it but not see it, but that doesn't mean that it's simple to recognize it or simple to see it in the potential of video, but what does become, to put it all into perspective, and I don't think I understood this when I watched your video, in which you were very complimentary, Rich. And I didn't understand it then, but I do understand it now. it's actually not as complicated as I thought. Even though I was always making these lesson plans and giving so much time to them, all I've ever been doing is using principles of story and stealing from storytellers, whether we're talking visual storytellers, especially novelists, great literature, and the likes of Quentin Tarantino or Vince Gilligan, as I pronounce his names, from Breaking Bad, who are craftsmen and craftswomen who know what they're doing, and they know how to keep an audience like that and wanting more and curious, and not just engaged by watching, but wanting to talk about it, wanting to put it into words, wanting to share with your friend Darren that you've just discovered also watches The Wire. These are the things that I've been using and borrowing from and stealing, and it's as simple as that. And I think that a little bit of understanding of how story works can stand you in very good stead as a teacher. Borrow these narrative hooks, which is what they are.
Mm.
Yeah.
Narrative hook. That's a nice term, actually. Narrative hooks.
Oh, and the reason I said that, yeah, that's a standard term actually from literature. But the reason Rich has got the book, because I asked Rich if he could give me permission to use the video, he very kindly said yes. So I felt I had to send him a little gift to say thank you. Hence the book video telling that. So thank you, Rich.
Which you can buy at, I don't know, what'd you buy at Amazon?
Well, we'll drop a link below.
Yeah,
to Lessons Stream and to
Neil's good at sorting all that out.
I can include a special little discount code if you like.
So that'd be wonderful.
That's for the ebook.
Right.
The ebook. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll put that below. So you got to watch all the video and then purchase, obviously.
So
it's interesting because it's go ahead, Rich.
Well, no, I was going to kind of move things along actually, because I think the next thing is probably to talk about sort kind of what you're doing with Lesson Stream now, Jamie. But I don't know if you had a question about the sort of previous stuff first, Neil.
Well, I was just going to add on something to his three points. Like when I first started teaching, I don't know. I was always a bit of a book nerd. Wasn't very. I never felt very interesting, you know, early on in life. So, you know, now, you know, I feel fairly competent as a storyteller or as an engaging teacher, at least. And one thing I always thought of when you mentioned your three things was, you know, when you're mining your own stories, that, you know, if there's a teacher out there that's like, I don't feel like I'm a very interesting person. What, you know, you can make stuff from nothing, but also, you know, just to say yes to life and experiences. I mean, if we look at Jamie's background of biochemistry, musician, it's just a wealth of different things that you can draw from. So, you know, the more that you live life, the more stories I would presume you would have.
That the story about the becoming a teacher probably is kind of I've got less of an inclination to use stories like that in teaching or training contexts, to be honest. Because I think I would prefer, you know, I've been writing copy for my story course, for example, and for a long time I said training teachers to tell better stories. And recently I looked at it and no, it's not about training teachers to tell better stories, it's about training teachers to tell stories better, which is a difference. Because I think that my interest in stories for the classroom lies in the sort of unremarkable stories, the ordinary stories. But even if they're ordinary, and even if they're unremarkable, you've got to find the meaning in them. They've got to be meaningful. And I think it's better to use stories of that type, short, unremarkable, ordinary stories than to try and find those remarkable, extraordinary stories. Because at the end of the day, if you're going to go for the extraordinary or remarkable, where do your students go from there if we want them to find a story of their own within yours? Maybe they can, but it's kind of setting the bar a bit too high. And there's an activity I try and train teachers to get into, and it's called, and I mentioned my story course, and this is one of the first things we do. Rather than on Monday morning, ask your students, what did you do at the weekend? Change the question. Say, does anybody have a weekend story to share? And the whole idea behind a weekend story is that exact thing, looking for something which is ordinary or unremarkable, but can be turned into a story. It could be something as, you know, well, you know, I'm looking, as you know, I'm looking for a dog, you know, and we went to the cat and dog home to see if there was a dog, and I want an Alsatian. And they didn't have any Alsatians at the weekend, but they did have this little Labrador. And I don't usually go for Labradors, but this one was just so adorable. And now I've left with a dilemma. Do I wait for an Alsatian or do I go back and get this Labrador, which may have been taken by now? That's an example of quite a good weekend story, actually. That's a particularly good one. But they don't always have to be as special as that. But you get the idea. It's a everyday, it's a good thing about that one, it's a dilemma story as well, so it's particularly interactive.
So it's like a Seinfeld kind of,
well,
just an ordinary
comedians do this particularly well, and so do novelists. They're able to look at the ordinary and find meaning in it. So a story which is an extraordinary story tends to be a whole succession of ordinary events put into a special narrative, I guess. Although I'm not sure if that's true. I'm thinking of some pretty extraordinary stories and they've got some pretty extraordinary events taking place. So I'll take that back. Yeah. But the idea is to try and find your weekend story and always lead by example. So you can't just, this is the other thing. If anyone's telling the stories, it should be the students. I reject that. You've got to give students something to go on. You've got to give them a way in. You've got to share you've got to lead by example. You've got to share your weekend story. It's going to take you 90 seconds to do so, or 2 minutes max. And then you've got to try and get your students to share theirs. Mm. And if they've got nothing to say, they then go to, well, what did you do at the weekend anyway? But by doing that every week, you're getting your students into this mindset as well. They're actually actively looking for their weekend stories. Mm. Even if they're not sharing them, even if you're getting total silence, after week 14, you might get Juan saying, well, actually, I've got a weekend story. And then you can work with something, see? Because it is actually hard. Mm. Hard for teachers. It's hard for me. It's hard for all of us. So we can't just magic our students to do it. But it's a nice activity.
Yeah, I mean, because there is an element of sort of putting yourself on the line with that, isn't there, as well? It's like, you know, definitely not everything is interesting, right? I could definitely tell you parts of my weekend which are incredibly tedious. And you know, it makes me think of times when I've kind of prepped lessons. I don't know if you can, you know, if you guys can relate to this, but this idea when you get a lesson together and you're just like, wow, this is fantastic, you know, this is gonna go amazing, and then you kind of run it and it's like the students don't really get into it. And you're like, what happened with that? And that, I think that can happen with stories as well, right? And that's the risk of, you know, you do have to put yourself in the line a little bit. And sometimes, you know, I mean, Neil can really relate to this because he actually did stand-up comedy for a while. So, you know, that idea of things maybe bombing sometimes and dealing with that.
Well, bombing's part of the process. I mean, the only tip I'd say for stuff like that is never do a gig at a strip club. Because, yeah. and wear tight pants. There's a whole multitude of reasons of why that doesn't work, but yeah. You know, I relate a lot to what Jamie is saying. And it's funny how universal narrative is. And I know it's even part of psychology. You know, we do refer to the narrative self and the experiential self. Yeah. And there's a whole lot of mental issues, but a whole lot of problems that people have are to do with the discongruity between the two.
That's really interesting. That's like the stories you tell yourself about yourself and what you actually experience.
Yeah, and also, you know, like the way that we experience things, if we don't understand it, we turn it into a narrative that we can understand. So, for example, if someone has sleep paralysis and they wake up and they can't move, then if they're not aware of the whole condition, you know, back in the Middle Ages, it might be an old hag that you might give yourself this story of an old hag that sat on your chest, or more recently, you know, aliens entering into your room and abducting you. So, you know, that's an extreme example, but, you know, when you're talking about abuse and stuff like that, you often get these people that create these narratives that it's almost like their fault that they've done something wrong. So it's funny how we talk about it as a narrative and what, you know, with teaching, but it's universal, and it's to the point where we actually, it is within our psychology and biology.
Like, it's like so the way of making sense of the world.
I always say that Jamie's really touched on something, you know, basic to human nature.
I've just stolen it, Neil. Yeah. Although you just said that, yeah. Although you did say I've just touched on it, yeah.
So,
narrative self.
So what are you doing with the new lesson stream then, Jamie? What's going on with lesson stream these days?
Well, the new lesson stream now is it's a community, first and foremost, and we've got about 280 teachers in the community, and you get access to the new lesson stream library. I create a new lesson stream every week based on videos or images or pieces of art or anecdotes sometimes. And there's also the courses. Let me, I'm just trying to find something to show you. In fact, I've just got this. Can you see that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let me just.
Looks like a Dr. Seuss.
Yeah, it is a bit, isn't it? Yeah. So that's the lesson stream story course. Here we go. Fish coming. And that's coming next. And we have webinars, guest webinars. 2 weeks ago, we had the senior editor of Hello Magazine Online join us to give us a workshop teaching us how to be digital online celebrities for the day. It was pretty, pretty special. Mm-hmm. And the community, a forum for discussion and interaction. It's all about, you know, training teachers and equipping teachers to be and to do all these things that we've been talking about. It's
Where do they go for that?
Lessonstream.com. Yeah.
Links below.
Links below. Very kind of you to include that, I must say.
Uh-huh, yeah. Yeah, it's definitely interesting hearing you talk about it, and also you kind of mentioned before something about how you didn't really have any time, or you haven't had much time for marketing as you wished, right? And it makes me wonder about that, because I to hear you explain it, I feel like I'm getting new information about it here. So my understanding was definitely not complete from just kind of quickly perusing the website. And I think I even sort of signed up for the newsletters and stuff and had a look at some of those that were very incredibly well put together. But still, I wasn't, yeah, the sort of community element and all the rest of it. And you're making a new lesson every week.
Yes, most weeks. Occasionally miss a week, but most weeks, yes. That's the idea. I'm working on one right now, in fact, called Cats in the Air.
That's intrigue already. That's the next thing. 2020 COVID, 2021 Cats in the Air.
Yeah. Cats in the Air.
I remember I used to live in a place in Valencia when I was still in Spain. And you know how in Valencia, I don't know if they have this in Barcelona as well, maybe they do, but a lot of the buildings in Spain, they have this like space in the middle of the building, and they need to have that because of the heat. Like if you have a big building, then you need to have this kind of area in the middle so that it kind of aerates, otherwise it just collects heat. And in this particular apartment that I had, my apartment actually overlooked that middle bit. So it didn't look out to the streets, but mine facing the other way. It was a very nice apartment. It got lots of natural light and stuff. But the area in this building, this was a big building, and the area was quite kind of spacious and open. And there was a massive like community of like homeless cats living on there. And they were fascinating to watch. Like I remember I'd be on my computer and I'd kind of just look to my left, like out my window. And I could just see them like doing all kinds of strange things, you know, sort of playing with each other, or one of them sitting here in a weird way or whatever. So there you go. That's not your story, is it?
No, but it could turn into a story about cats in the air quite easily. That one. Yeah, for sure.
And if Rich puts that one together, we'll release that on here as well.
I always imagine it to be a bit smelly, because we've got all these wild cats around Barcelona, and you can notice, you know, they're there because they smell a little bit. Yeah. But it wasn't
healthy. No, well, mine was my apartment was quite high up, so maybe if you were a bit lower down, it was. Like, but for me, I think I might have been maybe seven or eight stories up. So, yeah, smell didn't get to me. No.
Mm-mm. Yeah, you see, we even live on stories.
I'm thinking that it's probably about time that we unfortunately should start wrapping this up. So I've been Neil Teacher of Team Teacher fame. So if you're looking for more stuff from myself, teamteacherchina.com, where we have all our PowerPoint materials that you can use and get going with straight away. We've got our YouTube channel where we explain some of those materials, and we actually have some teaching videos on life in China. Team Teacher Baby, about my life as a teacher and my journey as a parent, and the combining those two together, and Team Teacher English, where it's just a whole bunch of those PowerPoints put into short little videos that you can give as homework, or they can study by themselves. And Professor Rich?
YouTube.com Professor Rich is my dead English teaching channel. Then you've got Prof Rich Gaming, where I play video games. And then you've got Up and Coming Project, BritishPlease.com, which currently doesn't actually exist. So that's me.
But if we say please enough, I'm sure it will.
British
and Jamie, please let us know where, you know, we can contact you, where we can find you, and any final thoughts that you would like to give, please.
Final thoughts, or find me at Instagram, @JamieKeddie. And Final thoughts. Whereas racing pigeons may be a popular sport with some people, never try racing crabs. Doesn't work.
Oh.
How's that?
So talking from personal experience?
No, I was just thinking about it the other day. Never tried it, never will.
Fantastic. Perfect way to end.